off them. I wasn't sure why anyone would bother to vandalize the signs. Maybe they didn't want strangers to find Stockton. "Which way?" I asked Darla. Darla looked over her shoulder at me. "Right, I think. This should be Highway 20. It'll take us straight into Stockton." We rounded the corner and passed a burnt-out building on our left. The sign in front read Galena State Bank and Trust. We raced on past a whole series of burnt buildings, but none of the rest of them had signs. Peering around Darla, I saw something surreal. A few hundred yards ahead of us, a line of cars stood upright, resting on their front bumpers with their trunks in the air. They formed a wall that stretched as far as I could see to the left and curved away from us to the right. Where US 20 passed through the car wall, someone had built a heavy timber gate across the road. Almost before I'd processed what I was seeing, church bells began ringing furiously. A line of men popped into view one by one, their heads and shoulders above the low log gate. Every single one of them was pointing a rifle at us. Chapter 7. Darla must have seen the rifles, too, because she slammed on the brakes. I got off the bike and stepped up beside her. "I doubt if any of them can hit us from this far off," she said. "Yeah," I replied. "How about if I walk up there with my hands up and try to talk to them, and you turn Bikezilla around so that if they start shooting, we can ride out of here in a hurry?" Darla paused. "Okay." She pulled me close for a kiss. "I'll get out the binoculars and keep a lookout. If I yell, run back as fast as you can. And be careful." "I will." I held up my hands with my palms open and started trudging down the road toward the guns. The wind was in my face, blowing bits of ice that stung my skin. I had to squint, making everything look indistinct. As I got closer, I could see the car wall better. It was bizarre, made up of every conceivable make and model of automobile, from huge pickup trucks and SUVs to Priuses and Mini Coopers. Their front bumpers were planted in the ground, hidden by the snow. The rear bumpers rose in the air at various heights so that the arrangement looked like a monstrous row of multicolored teeth gnawing up from the ground. Each car touched its neighbor on both sides, forming an impassable wall. I couldn't tell what held them upright. I got to within 100 feet of the gate and yelled, "Hello, is this Stockton?" Someone yelled back, "We're closed." "You got a doctor here?" "Yep. She's closed, too." "I can trade."
"Trade what?"
"Guns, seeds, food." A lean man wearing a chocolate-brown coat and overalls set his rifle aside, climbed over the log gate, and started walking toward me. I noticed he was walking to one side of the road, carefully staying out of his buddy's line of fire. I briefly toyed with the idea of sidestepping to put him between me and the guns, but there was no point. He could easily sidestep also. He stopped about 10 feet from me.
"Who are you?"
"Alex Halprin."
"From?"
"Warren."
"No, you ain't. Warren only sends 4 guys here to trade, and I know 'em all."
"I live on Paul Halprin's farm, near Warren."
"Don't know him. Said you got guns to trade? Any ammo?"
"No, just the guns. A MAC-10, maybe a pistol, too."
"Don't need 'em. Got plenty of guns, not enough ammo."
"What about seeds? I've got good cold-weather kale seeds. Stuff's full of vitamin C." The guy turned his head and spat sideways.
"Like the last guy who sold us seeds? Claimed they were turnip seeds."
"Didn't sprout?"
"They sprouted all right. Grew spurry weed. Useless."
"This is kale. Same stuff Warren trades. It cures scurvy."
"Maybe. Maybe you're the King of England, too. Don't rightly know. What are you trying to trade for, anyway?"
"Medical care. The guy on the back of our bike's been shot. He's lost a lot of blood."
"Best you put him out of his misery and give him a proper burial, then." The guy shrugged. "Best hide the spot you bury him in, too, lest you want a Flenser gang to dig him up."
Whatever a Flenser gang was, I didn't think telling him that the guy probably was already in one would help my case at all. "So what would it take to buy medical care for this guy?" I asked.
"How about 2 hog carcasses?" I've got some pork, but not that much. I hear they got plenty up in Warren.
Yeah, thousands, but they're not mine.
The guy spat again in the snow. You're no use to me then. So either go back where you came from or skirt around Stockton out of rifle range. You come within shooting range, we probably won't waste a bullet on you, but you never know.
He turned and strode back toward the gate. I ground my foot into the snowy road. I knew they'd give me anything I wanted for a packet of kale seeds if I could prove they were good. I stomped back down the road to Darla.
No luck? She asked.
Nope. They don't believe the kale seeds are real. I can't think of any way to prove it to them other than germinating a few, and by the time we do that, our bandit will be dead.
Well, we can take him to Doc McCarthy in Warren. It looks like about 12 miles on the map. Take us an hour and a half, maybe two.
Let's do that. I mounted Bikezilla's rear seat. By the way, do you know what a Flenser gang is?
I've heard rumors. You don't want to know.
If I didn't want to know, I wouldn't have asked.
Okay, a flensing knife is used to strip skin or fat from an animal, originally a whale.
So a Flenser gang?
Well, if the rumors are true, it's a gang that survives by roaming around and butchering animals to eat.
But almost all the wild animals around here died from the ash after the volcano. They got silicosis.
Flensers butcher the animals that ventured outside but survived, the ones that were smart enough to cover their mouths and avoid breathing the ash.
I was silent for a moment, listening to the harsh noise made by the cold air rasping in and out of my lungs.
So we might have a cannibal strapped to the back of the bike.
Yeah. Great, I said in a voice as grim as my mood. Let's go.
Chapter 8. An hour and a half later, we were back in Warren. It was aggravating that more than halfway through the first day of our journey, we were barely more than 5 miles from where we'd started. Warren, unlike Stockton, had no wall. They hadn't had much problem with bandits so far, probably because Warren is a pimple on nowhere's butt, while Stockton sits astride Highway 20, which connects Dubuque and Galena with Chicago. When we stopped at the clinic, Darla worked on untying our cannibal from the load bed while I squatted by his head, checking to see if he was still alive. When Darla rolled him over, he started thrashing and mumbling crazy stuff, which I figured counted as a sign of life. We carried him inside. The waiting room was cold and dark, but light streamed from one of the exam rooms down the hall. When we'd first arrived in Warren last year, the doctor's office had always been packed with people suffering from scurvy. Now, with the steady supply of kale from our farm, we'd often find the place deserted. Dr. McCarthy and his assistant, Belinda, were in one of the exam rooms working on patient files by the light of an oil lamp. Darla and I carried in our cannibal and heaved him on top of the examination table.
"Who's this?" Dr. McCarthy said. "I don't recognize him."
"One of the guys who attacked our farm yesterday." The doctor picked up one of the bandit's hands and looked at it for a moment, then held his fingers to the guy's lips.
"Lost a lot of blood. He needs a transfusion. We've got a donor system set up, but nobody's going to want to donate to a bandit."
"We need information from him," I said.
"I'll do what I can, Hippocratic Oath and all, but I can pay 200 kale seeds.
Darla shot me a glance so heated that I felt my face scorch.
"Couldn't you just wake him up, give him some adrenaline or uppers or something?" she asked Dr. McCarthy.
"If I had any epinephrine or amphetamines, which I don't, they wouldn't work. He's unconscious from blood loss. The only way to wake him up is to give him a transfusion and fluids."
"So can we buy him a transfusion?" I asked.
"Yes. You don't happen to know this guy's blood type, do you?" Dr. McCarthy asked. "I'm out of test kits."
"No idea."
Dr. McCarthy turned to Belinda. "Who's next on the O-Neg list?" She had already retrieved a single sheet of paper from the desk drawer.
"No, say Myers, but she gave 38 days ago.
And she can't weigh 110 pounds dripping wet. Who's after her?"
"Kyle Henthorne. He's at 29 days, though."
"That's okay. He's a big guy. Will you go get him?" Dr. McCarthy held out a key ring.
Belinda took the keys to his Studebaker, the only working car left in Warren, and left. Dr. McCarthy turned to me and Darla. "Help me move him onto the floor next to the exam table, would you?" As we lifted the bandit, I noticed his eyes were rolling around as if they were loose in his head. We put pillows under his feet to help treat him for shock and covered him with a blanket. "You want me to take this bandage off?" I asked. "No," Dr. McCarthy said. "He might bleed more, which he can't afford. Wait till after he's had a transfusion." About 20 minutes later, a big, florid-faced guy burst into the exam room with Belinda trailing behind. "What's this Belinda tells me about donating again, Doc? My last one wasn't even a month ago." He stopped in the middle of the room and stared at our bandit. "Who is this guy? You know I'm happy to help out neighbors, but I've never seen him." "This one pays, Kyle," Dr. McCarthy replied. 100 kale seeds. "Damn! Bleed me till I faint." Henthorne hopped up onto the exam table and rolled up his sleeve. "Why do I feel like I just failed Medical Ethics 101? Dr. McCarthy said. "Because you did." Belinda was glaring at him. Dr. McCarthy shrugged and got to work. They set up a gravity feed transfusion, straight from Henthorne's arm into the bandit's. The transfusion had been going about 5 minutes when the bandit woke and started thrashing. I was pressed into service to keep him from ripping out the IV needle. Keeping his arms pinned to the floor was easy. He was feeble. Dr. McCarthy cut off the transfusion after about 10 minutes. "You sure you don't need any more?" Kyle asked. "I feel fine." "No, I don't want to take any chances. I feel bad enough about this already," Doc McCarthy replied. "I'll bring your kale seeds by later. Belinda, will you get him something to eat and then drive him home? Keep him in a waiting room for about 15 minutes. I don't want him to pass out." Belinda and Kyle left the exam room. Dr. McCarthy started unwrapping the ACE bandage from the bandit's side. As the doctor gently pulled the packing out of the wound, the bandit screamed and started bucking. "I wish I had some kind of sedative left," Dr. McCarthy said. "I could put pressure on his jugular, try to knock him out," I offered. "No, no, he's already suffering from anemic hypoxia. That'd only make it worse. Just hold him." Dr. McCarthy cleaned and repacked the wound on the bandit's belly. He passed out again while the doctor stitched him up. Then I had to roll him over so Doc could work on the entrance wound at his back. "How long will he be out?" I asked when Dr. McCarthy finished. "Can't tell for sure. Could be an hour, could be he never wakes up. But he'll probably sleep for 3 or 4 days and heal okay." "I want to go out to my uncle's farm," I said. "Can you keep him here until Darla and I get back?" "You mean restrain him?" Dr. McCarthy said. "No, I won't do that. You could talk to the sheriff about it, though." "I guess we'll stay here until he wakes up then." I looked at Darla. She nodded. "Is there some place to sleep around here?" "We have a cot in the other exam room. One of you can use the exam table." Dr. McCarthy picked up the tray that held his instruments. "So long as you're waiting for him to wake up, could you take the night shift for us? Belinda and I have been trading off for 6 months now. A couple of nights off would be great." "You sure?" I said. "What if a patient comes?" "Yeah, you'll be fine. I'll show you where my house is. If you need me, one of you stay with the patients, the other run to get me." Somehow I got stuck on the exam table that night while Darla got the cot. Well, I knew how it happened. I offered her the cot, and she said, "Sure, thanks," when I was hoping she'd say, "No, you take it." Anyway, the metal table was uncomfortable despite the sleeping bag I spread over it. So I was awake to hear the moans emanating from the room next door when the bandit woke up. I rolled off the table and padded over there in my socks, trying not to wake Darla. In the hall, we'd left the lantern turned to its lowest possible setting in case the guy woke up. I turned the lantern a little higher and carried it into his room. He was rolling around under his blankets, moaning, "Ah, air, ah, air," in a breathy voice. I figured out what he wanted and poured some water from the jug on the counter into a plastic cup. His hands were shaking so badly he couldn't hold the cup. So I propped him up with one arm and poured the water slowly past his lips. After he drank about half the cup, he started coughing. That went on for a while, a series of dry, rasping coughs that had to be painful with his fresh stitches. When his coughing subsided, he motioned at the water cup, and I helped him drink the rest of it. As I turned to put the cup away, he said in a surprisingly clear voice, "Thank you." I put the cup down and came to his bedside. "What's your name?" "Ralph." "You know where Bill got that shotgun?" He grabbed my arm, clutching it tightly enough to hurt. The bones, they're burning, burning. White ends turn brown and blacken in the fire. He levered himself partway upright and stared into my eyes. "The flame eats, but it's never satisfied. It eats all night, every night, but there's never enough bones." "What about the shotgun?" I pried his hand off my arm. He moaned and whispered, "There are too many bones." Then, abruptly, he fell back to sleep. Chapter 9. Dr. McCarthy returned to the office early the next morning. He poked his head into the exam room, letting in a sliver of light. "You guys up?" I groaned. I'd barely slept. "I am now. Bring your breakfast into the office so we don't have to light another lantern, would you?" "Sure." I rolled out from under the blankets and groped for my coat. Darla was already up. Dr. McCarthy stepped into the room and raised the lantern. Darla grabbed a couple of packages of ham from our pack, and I picked up our toothbrushes and a pail of wash water. A crust of ice had formed on it overnight. All three of us trooped into the hall. "I've got to check on the patient," Dr. McCarthy said. Darla and I waited in the dark hallway while the doctor checked on Ralph. It took less than 5 minutes. "How is he?" I asked as Dr. McCarthy emerged. "Unconscious. Pulse and breathing are okay, but he's running a fever." "You think he'll wake up today?" "No way to tell." As we were eating breakfast, the mayor of Warren, Bob Petty, joined us. He was the only person I knew who'd retained his pre-volcano roundness in his face, belly, and stentorian baritone voice. "Heard you got a bandit here, Jim." "They brought him in." Dr. McCarthy tilted his head at Darla and me. "You catch him out at your uncle's farm?"
"Sort of," Darla said. "We killed two of them. One got away."
"We can't have his type here. I'll send the sheriff to escort him out." "You will not," Dr. McCarthy said emphatically. "Bandit or not, he's a patient, and he's unconscious, hardly a threat." "Folks are worried." Dr. McCarthy stared at the mayor until the silence got uncomfortable. The mayor cleared his throat. "Well, he wakes up. You fetch me or the sheriff. We'll talk about it then." Dr. McCarthy changed the subject, asking about the latest news. The mayor had traded some pork for a hand-cranked battery charger and an emergency radio, which they were using to monitor a few shortwave stations still transmitting. Rumors and speculation abounded. The Chinese had annexed California, Oregon, and Washington, bringing in troops under the guise of humanitarian assistance. Mexico had closed its borders and started shooting American refugees. U.S. forces stationed in Afghanistan had left and were now occupying farmland in Argentina. Texas had seceded, and religious fanatics in Florida were agitating to follow suit. Half of Congress and four Supreme Court justices had resigned en masse and threatened to set up an alternate government. Some of them had been arrested. Black Lake, the huge military subcontractor that ran the camp where Darla and I had been imprisoned last year, had opened offices inside the Pentagon and White House. There was no way to know if any of the rumors were true, and it didn't seem to matter much anyway. The only news that mattered to me was news of my parents, and none of that came in over the shortwave. Belinda came in just as the mayor was leaving. She smiled and shook his hand, but her eyes were wary. When we'd cleaned up from breakfast, Belinda put us to work organizing patient files. All the office staff had left, so the filing was way behind. Having us work with the records was a violation of HIPAA rules, Belinda said, but she didn't sound particularly worried, and I wasn't sure what she meant by HIPAA anyway. Each patient had a folder with brightly colored tabs that slotted into one of the open bookcases around the office.
One entire bookcase, packed with records, had been marked deceased. After a while, I started looking inside the folders. I knew I wasn't supposed to, but the work was tedious and I was curious. Every file ended with a sheet of copier paper, neatly torn in half. They all had the same handwritten heading, Certificate of Death. Under that, in smaller letters, it read, Prepared by James H. McCarthy, M.D. Every sheet listed a time, date, and cause of death. The causes varied wildly. Stroke, exposure, heart attack, periodontitis, whatever that was. Darla started looking in the files, too, and we called out causes of death as we worked. Blunt trauma from a fall, chronic bronchitis aggravated by silicosis, pneumonia, renal failure. Then I heard a soft slap as the file Darla was holding hit the counter. Jesus H. Christ, she whispered. What is it? I asked, turning toward her. She didn't respond, just slid the file along the counter to me. There were two death certificates stapled to the file. The top one was for Elsa Hayward. I'd never heard of her. Cause of death? Hemorrhage during childbirth. I lifted it to read the second certificate. Jane Doe Hayward, suffocated in childbirth. A full sheet of paper protruded below the death certificates. Elsa had evidently been a patient of Dr. McCarthy's for a long time and had a chart. The last entry on the chart read, If she'd been born 6 months ago, I could have saved them both. The last phrase was repeated, ground into the paper with such force that it had torn through twice. I could have saved them both. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? His scrawled signature was smeared, bleeding into the page. The paper rippled. I ran my finger across it, feeling it pop and crackle under my touch. Suddenly I realized what I was touching. Dried tears. I pulled my hand away from the file and swallowed hard, deeply embarrassed, as if I'd opened a door and found Dr. McCarthy behind it, sobbing. I gently closed the file and set it in its place on the bookcase with the other records of the deceased. Darla hugged me, her eyes shining with unshed tears. After that, we quit opening the files. After lunch, we hauled water for the office on Bikezilla. Warren's water system had failed shortly after the volcano erupted, so we filled jugs and pails from the nearest working well, about 2 blocks away. Well water never freezes, even in the hardest winter, although the pipes and hand pumps can. As I set one of the jugs on the counter, I must have winced because Darla said, How's your side? It's fine, I replied. Let me check it. I should change the bandage anyway. I'm fine. Let's see what else Belinda wants us to do. After I check your bandage. I sighed, sank into a chair, and started taking off clothing. When Darla began removing the bandages from my side, I bit back a scream. I knew it would hurt. It had ever since I'd been shot, but not this badly. The 3 puncture wounds were swollen and oozing pus. Red streaks radiated from my side like cobwebs. Wait here, Darla said. Dr. McCarthy took one look at it and said, Cellulitis manifesting as severe erythema. Ery what? I asked. The puncture wounds are infected. Can you treat it? Darla asked. Yes. But, I asked. Dr. McCarthy shook his head. But nothing, just a sec, he said, and left the room. When he returned, he was carrying 7 large white pills and a cup of water. Take one now, and one every day until they're gone. Should take 2 a day, but I don't have enough for that. There was writing on the pills, but I couldn't make it out in the low light of the lantern. What are they? Cipro, full-spectrum antibiotic. That must have been hard to come by. I took the glass of water and swallowed a pill, feeling the lump it made as it passed down my throat. There's a guy in Galena dealing in it. I don't know where he gets it. I suspect he has access to the government stockpile. Why'd the government stockpile it? Darla asked. It's one of the best treatments for anthrax. The stockpile was a civil defense measure. "How much do you have left?" I asked.
6 tablets.
I picked up my jacket from the floor and pulled the bag of envelopes holding the kale seeds out of the inner pocket. I extracted 2 envelopes.
Darla glared at me.
"Use one of these to buy more Cipro," I told Dr. McCarthy as I handed them over. "I don't want anyone to go without because of me. I owe you 1 envelope for Ralph's medical care." Dr. McCarthy carefully tucked the seeds into his coat, frowning.
"Thank you, but I'm going to repay your generosity in about the worst way possible. I need to clean and debride those wounds."
"Debride?" I asked.
"Cut the dead flesh away."
"That's not going to feel particularly pleasant, is it?"
"Nope. Probably be the worst pain you've ever felt. I've been out of anesthetics for months, and buying more just isn't as important as antibiotics, fever reducers, antiseptics, and the like."
I didn't trust my voice not to quaver, so I nodded.
"If you're lucky, you'll pass out. We can numb your side up a bit with snow."
"I'll get some," Darla offered.
"Get the cleanest snow you can find," Dr. McCarthy said. "Fill one of the small buckets from the supply room. I'll sterilize my scalpels."
While I waited for them to return, my mind wandered back to the last time I'd been in a hospital, before the volcano. I'd biked to Taekwondo and forgotten my keys. Nobody was home when I got back, so instead of waiting, I tried to break into my own house. I pushed the lower sash of one of our old-style storm windows inward, and the upper sash fell, snapping my arm at the wrist. I called Mom, and she hurried home from a PTO board meeting to take me to the hospital. She prowled the waiting room like a caged animal, pacing until we were finally taken to an exam room. There she quizzed everyone who came near us about the best treatments for broken bones, the advantages of a sling versus a cast, and how to spot infection. Pretty soon, all the nurses were avoiding us. When we finally got home, Dad glanced at my brand new cast and said, "Looks good," and turned back to his movie. My parents. They drove me crazy, but I still miss them desperately. Darla returned to the exam room. I lay on my side on the hard metal table and bit down on Dr. McCarthy's leather-wrapped stick. Darla packed snow over my wounds. She left the snow there until my side felt frozen and totally numb. But it wasn't. Darla sat on my legs to keep me steady, but when Dr. McCarthy started carving on my side, I bucked so hard she nearly fell off. I hoped, wished, prayed even that I'd pass out. No luck. I heard a muffled trumpeting sound and was puzzled for a moment before I realized it was me screaming around the stick clamped in my teeth. Some blood started to trickle from my side onto the table. I focused on the blood, watching it spread into a small, irregular pool.
"The bleeding's good," Dr. McCarthy said. "Helps clean out the wound."
I moaned around the stick.
"Almost done. There."
Darla reached up and took hold of the stick. I couldn't unclamp my teeth from it.
"Leave it there for now," Dr. McCarthy said. "We'll let the punctures bleed for a bit, then I'll clean and bandage them. He'll need the stick for that. I'm going to get fresh water and antiseptic." He left the room.
"Can I let go of your legs for a minute?" Darla asked me.
I nodded weakly.
Darla pulled her sleeve over her hand and used it to wipe the tears from my face. Until then, I hadn't even been aware I'd been crying. "You're a tough guy, you know."
I moaned.
Darla gently wrapped her arms around my shoulders and pressed herself against me. She softly kissed my eyelids, right, then left.
"Love you," she whispered.
I grunted back.
Dr. McCarthy came back into the room carrying a basin of water and 2 small bottles.
"I leave for 30 seconds, and you're making out in my operating room? Teenagers."
Darla quit hugging me and glared at him, but he ignored her as he prepared to wash my wounds. I caught the hint of a smile peeking out of the corner of his mouth. Washing and rebandaging the wounds didn't hurt as badly as the cutting had, but there were still fresh tears for Darla to wipe away. It took a couple of minutes for me to relax enough to release the stick from between my teeth. A wave of exhaustion washed over me. It was late afternoon, nowhere near bedtime, but I was suddenly so tired I could barely sit upright. I stumbled to my feet. Darla grabbed my arm, concern plain on her face. "I'm okay, just tired." I didn't want her to worry. She helped me down the hall to the exam room we'd slept in the night before, and I stretched out on the cot. My last thought before I drifted into unconsciousness. Why couldn't I have passed out a half an hour earlier?
Chapter 10. Darla's snoring woke me. She didn't snore all the time, but when she did, it sounded like a hibernating grizzly. She'd left an oil lamp burning as a nightlight. I watched her sleep for a while as she lay curled up on the exam table. Her face was gorgeous, golden in the lamplight, although the effect was ruined by the flutter her nostrils made with each rip-roaring snore. I thought about waking her. Sometimes a gentle shake would be enough to end her snoring. But we'd both had a long day yesterday, and my side hurt badly enough that I didn't think I could get back to sleep anyway. I rolled out of bed. I was dressed, but my boots were propped upright beside the cot. Darla must have taken them off me. I slipped on my boots, picked up the lantern, and went to peek out the back door of the clinic. It was pitch black and bitterly cold outside, still sometime in the middle of the night. I closed the door and went back down the hall to the room the bandit occupied. He was curled on his left side under three blankets. Most of his face was hidden, covered by long hair and a scraggly beard. The one eye I could see was open, shining in the lamplight as he stared at me. "You ready to talk?" I asked. He tried to say something, but started coughing instead. He hacked a huge wad of greenish phlegm onto the sheet. "Need to pee something fierce," he said finally. I sighed. "Bathroom doesn't work. You want to go in the pit toilet outside or just use a bedpan?"
"Try to get up, I guess."
"Okay." I grabbed a rag from the desk and tossed it at him. "Wipe up your mess first so you don't smear it everywhere." He dabbed feebly at the phlegm, then dropped the rag on the floor. I scowled at him, picked up a clean corner of the rag with two fingers, and tossed it into the laundry bin. He started to push himself upright, got to about 45 degrees, and cried out. He grabbed his right side and collapsed back onto the bed. When he regained his breath, he said,
"Better use the bedpan."
"Tell me when you're done," I said, when I returned with it. "I'll wait in the hall." I left the door cracked so I'd hear it if he tried to get out of the bed. It seemed like a long wait. I remember having to use a bedpan while I was staying at Darla's house after I'd been injured by Target the year before. Actually, what I used was her mother's second-best bread pan. We never did tell her mother about that. The memory of Mrs. Edmonds sat heavy in my chest. I'd known her for less than 3 weeks before she was murdered, but still, I missed her. I'd be dead now if not for her. She'd shown me a kindness I could never repay, a kindness that moved her to welcome a bleeding stranger into her home.
"Done," I heard from the exam room.
I went inside and took the bedpan from the bandit. It sloshed with urine so dark it was almost orange. I carefully set the stinking pan on the desk and lowered myself into a chair. "So, Ralph, you got that..."
"Ralph? Who's Ralph?"
"You said your name was Ralph."
"I did? When?"
"Last night."
"Don't remember that. No, I'm Ed. My dog's name was Ralph."
"Huh. Wonder why you told me your name was Ralph." He twisted his head and stared at the ceiling. "I need to know where you got that shotgun," I said. "Blue Betsy, remember?"
"Why am I here?"
"Because I need to know where the shotgun came from." This was getting old. "Trust me, I'd have preferred to leave you where you were. You'd have bled out or frozen to death."
"Might have been better if you had."
"Yeah, but you want to know where we got that shotgun. You going to kill me after I tell you?" "What? No." "You're just going to let me go? Tell me another one, kid. How do they do it here? hanging, or a bullet in the brain.
Neither. You've just got to move on and never come back.
Huh. Ed folded his arms and closed his eyes.
Where'd that shotgun come from?
Ed was silent.
I leaned forward and breathed out heavily, staring at him. I had to convince him to trust me, at least a little.
You hungry?
Yeah, but you ain't gonna feed me. Nobody's got enough food to waste it on half-dead strangers.
Wait here.
He laughed, a wheezy, half-hearted cackle.
I can't even sit up by myself.
He had a point. I returned to the room Darla and I shared. She was still loudly asleep. I dug through our supplies, pulling out packages of food. I thought about what would impress Ed, but while we had plenty of food, there wasn't much variety. I settled on a sandwich, two cornmeal pancakes for the bread with a slice of ham and a slab of goat cheese for the filling. Ice crystals shattered off the ham as I cut it, and the slice was hard as a board. We had no way to keep it warm. The cheese crumbled. As a finishing touch, I peeled an icy kale leaf off the stack and added that to the sandwich. Ed was staring at the door when I returned to his room. I put the sandwich in his hands.
That's for me? He asked.
Yeah, I replied. Don't eat it too fast. You'll barf.
I know.
I sat him up, propped against the wall. He took a bite, chewing slowly. He held the sandwich in front of him as he ate, staring at it like a kid with a new iPhone on Christmas morning. Well, like a kid would have stared at a new iPhone before the volcano. That kid would just toss the useless chunk of metal and glass aside and look for the good stuff. Food, clothing, matches, or weapons. I refilled his water cup. Ed set the water beside him and said,
So this is corn, lettuce?
Kale, I said.
Kale, okay. Cheese and a slab of...
ham. I was quiet for a while as Ed ate. Why'd your buddy leave you in that house, anyway?
I was slowing him down. I think he was going to put me out of my misery, but I got him to leave me there the same way I got you to back off. Pure D bluff. Told him I had one bullet left for the MAC-10. He didn't want to find out the hard way whether I was telling the truth or not.
Took balls. So what did you do before the eruption?
Before the eruption?
Yeah, like I went to high school, Cedar Falls High. Ed lifted the sandwich, staring at it, not eating.
Mandy used to love ham sandwiches.
Mandy?
I haven't thought about her in months. She was my life. How could I forget?
What about,
I guess you just go along, don't you?
I don't. Every day you do what it takes to survive. And every day what you're willing to do gets a little worse until you're...
Jesus, we were shooting kids.
I tried to break in to ask about the shotgun again, but his voice dropped to a whisper and he kept talking.
Dear God, what have I done? What have I become?
He buried his face in his hands and started crying, huge racking sobs that traveled in lurching waves down his belly. I was afraid he'd tear his wounds open. He was crying so hard. Tears leaked from between his fingers. I watched him, torn between disgust and an irrational desire to comfort the bandit who had attacked our farm, who would have killed Max and kidnapped Rebecca and Anna if he could have. It took a while for Ed's sobbing to subside to sniffles.
I was a bookkeeper, he said at last. I ran Peachtree for a machine shop in Eli. What happened to us? What happened to me? What did happen to you?
I must have let some of the scorn I felt color my voice. He pulled his hands from his face and stared at me with an expression of such naked torment that I forgot to ask him again about the shotgun.
It started with Ralph, Ed said. He was our dog. We were starving to death, Mandy and me. Then a couple weeks later, Mandy died anyway. Flu bug, or maybe just the diarrhea.
I should have just lain down to die next to her instead of burying her. A lot of people did, you know. I'd find them all over Eli, frozen together in their beds. The guys I ran with later laughed at them. But they did the right thing. Instead of doing something just a little worse every day, all in the name of survival, shaving yourself away until the last sliver of who you were is gone. I raised my voice, trying to break in. Would you let me? I still dream about him. Ralph. He was a good dog. Ed looked at me, his eyes stripped of color by the low light in his tears. They say you are what you eat, you know. Sometimes in my dreams I'm Ralph, my tail thumping the floor, just happy to see Ed come home. Sometimes in my dreams I'm a pile of bones, endless bones, burnt and cracked, feeding a greasy fire. He turned his head and started crying again, softly this time. I watched him cry for a moment. I need to know where that shotgun came from, I said for the 8,000,000th time. How did I? God damn it, Ed, tell me where my parents are. Without thinking about it, I'd taken a step toward him and raised my fists to my chin, planting my feet at a 45-degree angle, a fighting stance. I want to stay in Warren, rejoin civilization, and I want a pardon. No freaking way am I letting a guy who tried to kidnap my sister and cousin stay within 100 miles of Warren. The mayor was ready to throw you out while you were unconscious. Dr. McCarthy saved your ass. You tell me about that shotgun, and I'll try to convince them to let you stay until you're healthy enough to leave. Then you'll get the hell out. In fact, you'll get out of the whole state of Illinois. I'm not saying anything, then. I could beat it out of you. I raised my fists again. Go ahead. Ed's voice sounded hollow. I don't want to rejoin the gang. And if I leave on my own, I'm dead anyway. You may as well beat me to death. Wouldn't take much right now. Ed's eyes were brimming with tears again. I let out the breath I'd been holding, and with it my whole body deflated. I couldn't beat on a defenseless man, no matter what he'd done. You have to buy your way into Warren, I said. They aren't taking just anybody. They don't have enough food to do that. You've got to bring skills or supplies they need. You've got nothing to offer. The only thing Warren needs even less than bookkeepers are lawyers. So you buy me a spot, or convince your mayor to give me one. They don't want a bandit hanging around. That's your problem, if you still want to know about that shotgun. Gah! It was frustrating to admit it to myself, but he was right. He was half dead, but he still had the upper hand. And I didn't want to argue with him all night. I reached into my coat pocket and extracted an envelope. There are 200 kale seeds in here, more than enough to buy you admission to Warren, if you can buy it at all. I'm not going to hang around here and try to convince the mayor and sheriff that you're an okay guy. I'm not even sure you are. So here's the deal. You tell me everything you know, and I give you the seeds. Trading them for admission to Warren is your problem, not mine. How do I know the seeds are any good? God damn it! Okay, okay, I'll take it. I handed him the envelope. Talk. Danny, he... Who's Danny? You said the gun was Bill's. Danny's the leader of the gang I run with. Ran with, I mean. The Peckerwoods. Bill's just the guy Danny gave the shotgun to. Peckerwood? Isn't that some kind of insult? Yeah, I guess. It's also the name of a racist gang in Anamosa, in the state prison. I mean, I was never there, but that's where the leaders were when the volcano blew. Anyway, it started to get hard to find weapons and ammo. So Danny made a deal with some guards at one of the FEMA camps in Iowa. He got all kinds of weapons from them. Ammo, too. Most of the guns weren't military stuff, so I figure they were confiscating them from refugees. So maybe my dad is at that FEMA camp? Where is it? Might be, yeah. It's outside Maquoketa. Where's that? About halfway between Dubuque and the Quad Cities. That made it somewhere southwest of Warren. I wasn't sure exactly. So Danny was trading for the guns? What was he trading? I don't know for sure. Drugs, maybe.
We had all the good stuff. Antibiotics, painkillers, aspirin. Denny had a source in Iowa City, but he never took me along when he cut deals.
A pained look passed over Ed's face, and he moved his right hand to his side.
What else do you know?
Nothing. That's it, I swear.
I shook my head. 200 more kale seeds gone. And for what?
Chapter 11. When Darla woke, we packed Bikezilla, said goodbye to Dr. McCarthy, and headed from my uncle's farm. We'd only been gone 2 days, but even so, the farm looked different. Rebecca and Uncle Paul were out front nailing boards over a window. Most of the ground floor windows were already boarded over. As we made the turn into the driveway, Max came out the front door, leading a string of 4 goats by a rope. I grinned and waved, thrilled to see him up and about. He waved back before continuing to the barn.
"Didn't expect to see you back so soon," Uncle Paul called as we pulled up.
"Didn't expect to be back," Darla said.
"Had to do U-turn at Stockton," I said as I hugged him.
"Come into the kitchen," Uncle Paul said. "We've got fresh cornbread." We sat around the kitchen table for a while, catching up. Darla went out to Bikezilla and got our maps. She put the Iowa and Illinois maps on the table next to each other, and I traced a line from Warren to Maquoketa with my finger.
"So the biggest trick will be crossing the Mississippi River," I said. "Looks like there are bridges in Dubuque or Savannah."
"It won't be a big deal," Darla said. "That river that flows through the park behind the farm is frozen solid. We can ride Bikezilla across the Mississippi anywhere."
Uncle Paul was shaking his head.
"No way. That's the Apple River. It freezes almost every year, but the Mississippi never freezes over in Iowa."
"It's never below freezing for 9 straight months either," Darla retorted.
"We could cross at the lock near Bellevue, like last year. It wasn't too hard to climb down onto the barge stuck in the lock and back up the other side.
It hadn't been fun. I don't like heights. But I figured I could do it again."
"I'm telling you, it's not an issue. Look at these lakes." Darla pointed at a spot on the Mississippi just north of my finger.
"I'll bet there are a bunch of boat ramps here. We can ride right down onto the lakes and across the river, which will be frozen over, and into Iowa."
"Falling through the ice on a river is no joke." Uncle Paul sounded concerned.
"You can get swept downstream under the ice."
"The Mississippi is frozen so solid you could drive a semi on it," Darla said mildly.
"I'd bet my farm on it."
"We're not talking about betting farms. We're talking about betting your life and Alex's. This isn't..."
"My farm was my life," Darla said.
"Guys, take it easy," I said. "We can go to the lock to cross."
"That's where you found the barge full of wheat last year," Uncle Paul asked. "Stuck in the lock?"
"Yeah," I said.
"We could sure use some wheat," Uncle Paul said. "We've got to get some greenhouses growing something other than kale. A northern strain of wheat could work."
"I thought you couldn't just plant any old seeds," I said. "Didn't you tell me that's why we can't plant any of the corn we've been digging out of the ash and snow?"
"Corn hybridizes easily," Darla said. "Everything I planted at my farm was a sterile hybrid, kind of like mules are. Wheat's self-pollinating, so it's really hard to hybridize."
"Well, you can, but..."
I had to interrupt Darla before she really got going. She'd babble on and on about hybro-pollinizing stuff until I got even more confused.
"So what's all that mean?"
"Corn won't grow from seeds we dig up here. But if we can get wheat kernels off that barge, they'll probably sprout."
"Yep," Uncle Paul said. "I was hoping you could stop at the barge and pick up some wheat. It could make a big difference. We're going to run out of stored corn, and we need some kind of grain."
"That a-hole at the FEMA camp near Galena, Captain Jameson, said Blacklake had a contract to guard the barges," Darla said.
"Either the wheat's all gone by now, or those barges will be crawling with idiots in camouflage. They're not just going to let us ride up and help ourselves, you know."
"The lock is pretty much on the way, though," I said.
Uncle Paul fixed a stare on Darla. "Bringing back even a few pounds of wheat kernels would be a godsend if you can manage it. Might make the difference between surviving and starving if the winter weather doesn't break. I wouldn't ask if it weren't worth the risk."
We'll take a look. I glanced at Darla. Okay?
Her lips tightened, but she didn't say anything, which I took as enthusiastic agreement.
Right. So we spent some time mapping out a path to the lock that avoided Stockton and the FEMA camp near Galena.
When do you plan to leave? Uncle Paul asked.
Tomorrow morning, I said.
You sure you're up to it?
Darla took a hold of my wrist.
Maybe we should wait and make sure your infection is under control.
An infected wound is no joke, Uncle Paul said. Kill you if you don't take care of it.
No, I pulled my wrist free. I want to get moving.
How are you planning to break your parents out of that camp anyway?
I shrugged. I don't know, but I don't want to wait.
Be nice to have a bolt cutter and hacksaw for the camp fence, Darla said.
Take them out of my shop, Uncle Paul replied. I'll try to buy replacements in Warren.
We spent the rest of the day helping to fortify the house. Uncle Paul, Aunt Carolyn, and Anna worked on boarding up windows. Max slept most of the day. His head was healing okay, but the wound had left him weak. Darla, Rebecca, and I built and installed pairs of brackets on the inside of all three exterior doors. Then we cut heavy logs to fit into the brackets, barring the doors from the inside. It felt a little futile to me. Ed had started out as a normal guy, a bookkeeper. Would we all wind up like him, slowly forgetting our humanity in the daily struggle to survive? And when the world filled with people like Ed, bandits, murderers, rapists, arsonists, what good would a few bars on the doors do?
Chapter 12. By bedtime, I was exhausted and sore. Everyone else started to bed down on the living room floor, but Darla grabbed my hand and pulled me toward the stairs.
It's freezing up there, I complained.
I'll make sure you're warm enough, Darla whispered, grinning at me. My resistance evaporated. I'm sure Uncle Paul and Aunt Carolyn noticed us leaving, but they didn't say anything. Before we'd all started sleeping in the same room for warmth in April, Darla and I had shared the guest room. At first, my aunt and uncle had balked, but when they discovered we were sneaking out of our separate rooms every night anyway, they relented. We got extra blankets and comforters out of the linen closet and heaped them on Max's old bed. I took off my boots, coat, and coveralls. Even with three layers of shirt still on, I was freezing. I turned down the oil lamp to its lowest setting, and we dove under the covers, pulling them up over our heads. Darla pushed her back up against me, spooning for warmth. I wrapped my right arm over her and cupped my hand over her left breast. She moved my hand down to her stomach and held it there, which sort of sucked, but holding hands was nice.
I don't know how to say this right, Darla hesitated. But you do realize that your parents might already be dead.
I swallowed hard on the first reply that occurred to me. She was probably right. She went on, if they are dead, we're taking a big risk going into Iowa looking for them. We could get killed or trapped in another FEMA camp for nothing.
Yeah. I fell silent for a moment. But I've got to know for sure.
We might not be able to find out.
What, you don't want to go? You've volunteered. I didn't ask you. It's not like I'm dragging you.
That's not it. You're not going anywhere without me, doof.
I squeezed my arm around her, hugging her tighter.
All I was trying to do, was keep your expectations real. We might find them, sure, but they might be dead, or we might never even find out where they are, or what happened to them.
Never finding out what happened to them, that might suck worse than finding out they're dead.
Yeah, it might. Darla let go of my hand and started stroking my arm, which seemed strange at first, but was somehow comforting. We lay together in silence. Talking about my parents hadn't been particularly arousing, but now, with her hair brushing my face, her hands on my arms, and her body stretched out against mine, pressing into, well, everything, I started to get uncomfortably cramped. So I began softly nibbling on her neck. Darla closed her eyes and sighed. I moved up to kiss her ear. She laughed and pulled her head away.
You know that tickles.
Yeah, but you're so cute when you giggle.
I do not giggle. Never have, never will.
Whatever. I bent back toward her neck, but Darla fended me off with a hand.
You've got to quit giving away kale seeds like a pedophile with lollipops.
Huh? I said. Where'd that come from?
We need them to buy information. Maybe to buy your parents' freedom.
I know, but I've still got 17 packets.
We didn't need to give that bandit anything.
I didn't exactly give him the seeds. I traded for information.
And look, if we repay brutality with more brutality, how does it end?
We do something just a little bit worse every day, and soon enough, we're just like him.
We'll never be like him.
Maybe not, but we need to cooperate, to rebuild. Someone's got to start.
And why'd you bring it up now?
We could buy other stuff with those seeds, you know, she said in a husky voice.
Other stuff, I asked.
Like more condoms, maybe?
Oh, I said. Good idea.
Darla spun in my arms. Her knee dug into my thigh as she turned, but I was so aware of, other parts of her that I barely noticed. She tipped her head up and kissed me. When the kiss ended, I said, I think generosity makes you horny.
What do you mean?
Well, last year after we helped Katie and her mom, you pretty much attacked me. And today we helped Ed, saved his life even though we didn't really want to.
No, it's stupidity that makes me horny.
That's good then. I'm plenty stupid.
Yes.
Darla kissed me again. When she came up for air, she said, You sure are. I smiled and started undressing her. I usually thought the worst part of the winter was the frostbite or risk of starvation. At the moment, the endless layers of clothes seemed worse.
So, no condoms, Darla said. What do you want to do?
I'll show you. Darla giggled and finished undressing me.
Chapter 13. Later, Darla lay on top of me, her head resting on my shoulder. Despite the cold, our skin was slick with sweat. I stroked her back slowly, feeling tired and more relaxed than I had since the bandits attacked.
I've got something for you, I said.
What? Darla murmured.
I pushed a corner of the covers aside and started groping for my pants.
Quit letting the cold air in, Darla said.
I found what I was looking for in the pocket of my jeans. I pulled my hand into the tunnel of light the oil lamp cast into our cocoon and opened my palm, showing it to Darla. My face felt hot despite the cold air. I searched Darla's eyes, trying to see any sign that she liked my gift.
Where'd you get it? She asked.
Belinda gave me the gold chain. I tried to buy it from her, but she said she had extras. I swiped the nut from Uncle Paul's toolbox. You like it?
I love it.
My face grew hotter yet, but now it was a happy warmth. Darla took the chain from me and clasped it around her neck. The nut slid down the chain until it lay on the sheet between us.
Why'd you choose a 15/16? Nobody uses those.
That's what I found. And anyway, I always thought that you were a 16th short of a full nut. Darla groaned and slugged my shoulder, but she was smiling.
What do you want to do now?
Get some sleep? I capped the lamp and pulled the covers back over our heads.
No, I mean after.
After what?
After we find your parents, or find out what happened to them.
Maybe things will change if we find them. Get better.
I don't know, Darla said.
I guess we'll come back here. Keep helping my uncle. As a family, we've got a shot at surviving the winter.
Your uncle's okay, so don't take this the wrong way, but you're my family now.
I wasn't sure how to respond. I felt like I just shouldered a heavy backpack. Carrying that load was scary, but it felt good, too. Important. The winter could last a decade.
I'm not scared.
Darla was whispering, but her voice sounded determined.
I am, I said. But if we have to die in an endless winter, I'm glad we're together. I love you, you know.
I love you too. And if we don't have to die? I used to think that I'd finish high school, go to college. That's not going to be an option, Darla said.